I didn't take it personally, but people said, let's have some guest speakers during this special emphasis. So I said, that's awesome with me. So what we do is each year we look at our theme, we look for people that we felt know our community here at West Heights and could speak from their experience and their passion into the theme that we're doing. So we're next week I'll finish the series off. But today we have our final guest speaker as part of this 40-day adventure. And when I planned out the series back a few months ago and I looked at the topic for today, I felt like Michelle Brenneman, who's a part of our church here, would be a perfect person to speak to us because she really works in the front lines of what we wanted to talk about today. She works for MCC and as a program coordinator, and she's going to come and give today's sermon. I think you really like hearing from her, and she, as I said, she's working at the very thing that we're going to talk about today, so I think she brings great experience and great passion to the topic. So come on up, Michelle. Thanks for doing it this morning.
Thanks, Todd. No pressure there. Well, good morning. So our task this morning is to explore that last phrase in Luke 4 that we've been looking at. We've talked about the preaching good news to the poor, releasing the prisoners, giving sight to the blind last week. And now this week, how do we bring freedom to the oppressed? So I want to begin this morning by telling you an elephant story, and it's one probably many of you have heard before. It is an Indian fable, and it's about some blind men, six of them actually, that were in a village. And one day, one of the villagers told them that there was going to be an elephant in the village today. And they had no idea what an elephant was, and so they thought, well, we can't see the elephant, but we should surely be able to feel it and be able to kind of get an image in our heads about what an elephant is. And so they went and touched the elephant, and the first man said, he was touching the leg, and he said, hey, an elephant's a pillar. And the second man touched the tail and said, no, it's a rope. An elephant's like a rope. Third man said, oh, no, touching the trunk of the elephant, it's like a thick branch of a tree. The fourth man's touching the ear of the elephant and says, it's like a big hand fan. The fifth man, who's touching the belly of the elephant, says, it's a huge wall. And the sixth man said, it's a solid pipe as he grabbed onto the tusk. And they, of course, began to argue, how can it be a tusk? I have a pillar and a rope and a branch and a fan and a wall and a rope and all at the same time. And finally, somebody came along and said, what is going on? And they said, well, we're trying to decide what an elephant is. And so then they came, of course, upon the realization that they'd all been touching different parts of the elephant. And really, the elephant was all of those things. And so today, we have been talking and experimenting over the last 3 weeks about poverty, about prisoners, about disabilities and blindness. And I think those are parts of the elephant. But today, we're going to take a step back and look at the whole elephant, the systems and the structures that are the big picture of oppression in our world. So I want to begin by painting in broad strokes the picture of the elephant we're facing. Have you heard this phrase before? Is it up there? Okay, good. How do you eat an elephant? I don't know if you've heard that phrase before, right? And if you're going to, and I'm sure it probably tastes like chicken since most things do, but the answer is one bite at a time. And if we can kind of get beyond the absurdity of such a question, I think there's wisdom in that response. One bite at a time. I think it can inform us in how we should tackle the elephants that are in our lives. And of course, this elephant we're going to talk about today, the elephant of oppression. So let's begin by painting a picture of our elephant. Let's talk about what oppression is. And I like this definition of oppression. It says, oppression is the experience of repeated, widespread, systemic injustice. So if we think about the systems of our society as the bones of a house, like our healthcare, our economy, our education system, social services, infrastructure, government systems, they are the framework that hold up our house. They are the framework upon which we complete our individual houses. So we might be able to choose the color or the decor or the upgrades, the floor plan, depending on what neighborhood we live in. But our basic frames are actually quite similar. So one of the things that makes it difficult to get a handle on oppression is that we have trouble even seeing it. It kind of just melts into the walls of our lives. But when you think about it, it makes sense, because I know in my home, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the framing of my house. I mean, when we went and bought it, we did the home inspection, that kind of a thing. I suppose if there has a problem with the framing of the house, at some point I will be thinking about it quite intensely. But in the meantime, I'm thinking about what it looks like, how we function in it, how we live in it and decor it, what kind of upgrades we want to do to it. So by its very nature, oppression is difficult to see. So for the next couple of minutes, I want to focus our attention on the framework of this house of oppression. I want to give you a list of statistics about some common areas of oppression, and in each category, you're going to hear some global stats and then some local ones. Some might be Canadian or Ontario or even a few Waterloo region. So oppression doesn't recognize international borders, of course. So this is not a comprehensive list, but what I hope is that it will help give you a sense of the size and strength and magnitude of this elephant that we are facing. So human trafficking. There's an estimated 27 million slaves in the world today. Over 80% of those victims are female, and up to 50% are minors. 75% are trafficked into commercial sexual exploitation. Free the Slaves found cases in at least 90 cities throughout the U.S., with approximately 10,000 people in slavery in the U.S. at any given time. Here in Canada, the RCMP estimates 600 to 800 persons trafficked into Canada annually, predominantly for sexual purposes. And in addition, 1,500 to 2,000 are trafficked through Canada into the U.S. Aboriginal women are disproportionately affected. Gender. At least one of every three women in the world has been violently abused in her lifetime. Women and girls make up 75% of the poorest people in the world today. Waterloo Regional Police, here in our own city, respond every 1.4 hours to a call of a man assaulting his wife or girlfriend. Half of Canadian women have experienced at least one incident of violence since age 16, and the mortality rate for Aboriginal women when it comes to violence is three times the rate for non-Aboriginal women in Canada. Poverty. Over 3 billion people live on less than $2.50 a day, and there are 1 billion children currently in poverty. About 25,000 people die each day of hunger, and about 22,000 are children. Poverty costs Ontario residents $32 to $38 billion a year, the equivalent of 5.5 to 6.6% of our provincial GDP. And most of that cost is borne by the 1.9 million households with the lowest incomes in our province. A single person on Ontario Works receives about $585 a month, and the average rent in Waterloo Region for a one-bedroom apartment is $722. Homelessness. Over 1 billion people on the planet lack adequate housing, while around 100 million have no housing whatsoever. Now, 16% of all households in Waterloo Region pay more than 50% of their income on rent, and 39% of all households in our community spend more than 30% of their income on rent. 30% is kind of the key number, because if you spend more than 30% of your income on rent, then you have not enough money to pay for the other necessities of life, and you're at risk of running into trouble when it comes to being able to keep a roof over your head. Hunger and water. Unsafe water and the lack of basic sanitation causes 80% of diseases and kills more people every year than all forms of violence, including war. About 925 million people do not have enough food to eat. That's more than the populations of the U.S., Canada, and the European Union combined. Since 2008, the food bank use in Ontario has grown, and actually it should be 28%, which is an unprecedented increase in the last couple of years. And in 2010, 114 First Nation communities in northern Ontario were under drinking water advisories. 49 of those were listed at high risk. And I would mention Attawapiskat, which is one of the northern communities that MCC does work in. A couple of months ago, their water warning included not only not drinking the water, not bathing and washing in the water, but not breathing in the steam from the water as well. And wealth. By 1998, the people in well-to-do countries were 82 times better off than those in countries where the poorest 20% of the world's people live. Less than 10% of the world's health research budget is spent on combating conditions that account for 90% of the global burden of disease. In Ontario, the wealthiest earn $14 for every $1 the poorest earn. Here's a couple of specific examples. In 2007, a case of crucifixes purchased by St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York were traced back to a factory in China where girls as young as 15 were forced to work up to 19-hour days, 7 days a week. So even our Christian items that we choose to purchase are not exempt from being made in factories which abuse and traffic workers. 7 grocery items that are at high risk of being slave traded: coffee, chocolate, tea, strawberries, seafood, sugar, and poultry. Some of those from where they are off our shores in North America, some of them because we choose to use undocumented migrant workers. Those strawberries from California, they come cheap, but they come at a price. And finally, greed from Congo's mineral wealth has been a prime cause of the atrocities and conflict. And multiple armed groups use mass rape as deliberate strategy to intimidate and control communities as they profit from illicit trade in Congo's conflict minerals, many of which end up in our electronics, our cell phones, our laptops, and our digital cameras. That is one big elephant. And it's so overwhelming, it's hard to even listen to. I mean, really, what will I wear? What will I eat? How will I do my work without my laptop and cell phone? Even if I were to give all of my money away, sell my house, it would be an insignificant drop in the ocean of injustice and oppression. And so we are tempted to avoid it altogether. We think it's always been like this. Maybe they deserve it. My life isn't all sunshine and roses, and I'm managing. I have enough to deal with. We're even tempted to sometimes spiritualize it. God doesn't give people more than they can handle. Everything will be made right when we get to heaven. God's ways are not always. The poor will always be with us. Look at this verse from Jeremiah. This is the message Jeremiah had for the Israelites who were taken by King Nebuchadnezzar from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down, plant gardens and eat what they produce, marry and have sons and daughters, find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, so you too will prosper. The message is live. We have to live here in the now. We need to work at it. We need to make it as good as it can be. We are all in this together. So if we can't escape it or tune it out, how can we get a handle on how to respond? If this is our elephant, how do we take that first bite? Well, many people work long and hard at justice, and they do it for many reasons and sustain themselves in this work in a variety of ways. But as a people of faith, we don't do this just because of a philosophy or a theory or a feeling. We do it because we are called to respond. We know we have a call to free the oppressed, to work towards justice. It's mentioned time and time again in the Bible. This verse in Jeremiah says, "He defended the cause of the poor and the needy, so all went well. Is that not what it means to know me?" declares the Lord. Verses like this one highlight the work of justice and compassion that we're to be engaged in as followers of Jesus. We don't do it as an end unto itself or because it's a good thing, but we do it because this is how people catch a glimpse of what a world restored to God would look like. Matthew 20, Jesus is speaking. He says, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must become your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did, not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Our mission is to bring God's kingdom to life in the here and now, to create spaces where and become people who embody kingdom values like compassion and justice and love and grace. It is a call to swim against the current. I like this quote by Henry Nouwen. It says, "The society in which we live suggests in countless ways that the way to go is up. Make it to the top and to the limelight, breaking the record. That's what draws attention, gets us on the front page of the newspaper, and offers us the rewards of money and fame. The way of Jesus is radically different. It is not the way of upward mobility, but of downward mobility. It is going to the bottom, staying behind the sets, and choosing the last place. Why is the way of Jesus worth choosing? Because it is the way to the kingdom, the way Jesus took, and the way that brings everlasting life. This is the way of Jesus. This is our call to downward mobility. And I'd suggest to you this morning that as people of faith, our ability to affect social change, to bring about a social transformation, is rooted in our downward journey and in the spiritual transformation it brings in us. When we choose to follow the path of downward mobility, we choose to follow the way of Jesus, to be broken by the things that break his heart, to love as he teaches us to love, to share the extravagant grace that has been shared with us, to risk to live what we say we believe, that everyone has dignity and worth, that no one is beyond reach, that everyone deserves to have enough. And as we are transformed, as we become more like Christ, we begin to see our inconsistencies. We begin to lose our complacencies, and we begin to work for change. As people of faith, this process of spiritual transformation spurs us to social transformation. So if we hear the call to respond, whoa. Okay, could not have planned that better. That's good. Then we must also be clear about the cost of responding. The cost of responding. This is an interesting quote by Soren Kierkegaard. It sits uneasily with me, probably because I'm uneasy with the truth of it. He said, "The matter is quite simple. The Bible is very easy to understand, but we as Christians are a bunch of scheming swindlers. We pretend to be unable to understand it because we know very well that the minute we understand, we are obliged to act accordingly. Take any words in the New Testament and forget everything except pledging yourself to act accordingly. My God, you will say, if I do that, my whole life will be ruined. How will I ever get on in this world?" Peter says it this way, "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that has come on you to test you as though something strange was happening, but rejoice inasmuch as you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed." The call to respond is not for the faint of heart. It requires courage because it comes at a cost. We tend to think about the cost being money, and that is true, because my money can only be spent once. If I choose to spend it here, then I'm also choosing that I'm not going to be spending it here. But over and above that, I think that swimming upstream against the flow of our culture costs us perhaps dearly. It might be the cost of something we want, those strawberries in January, or a new piece of technology that we choose to do without because we have understood the ramifications of those choices. It may be the cost of our reputation. I don't particularly enjoy the thought of other people thinking about me that I don't want to be successful, or that I'm unsophisticated, or I'm an impractical idealist who just doesn't get how the real world works. It might be relationships, or it might be something else. Consumerism, capitalism, and individualism, as we practice them in North America, are very strong, and it is difficult and costly to make other choices. So we have heard the call, and we have counted the cost, but what do we do now? How do we put intention into action? And here, perhaps if I had gone to seminary, I could have come up with a third C, but instead, you are stuck with a W, ways to respond. I like this quote. by Benjamin Jowett. We cannot seek or attain health, wealth, learning, justice, or kindness in general. Action is always specific, concrete, individualized, and unique. These big concepts don't happen in the abstract. They are birthed through specific action. Structures and systems are made up of people. They're made up of individuals. So the big picture actually begins to come back to a more focused picture on what can I do one-on-one, person-to-person, individual-to-individual. I don't, I'm not a scientist, and I don't know very much about physics, but what I do like is a thing called the butterfly effect in chaos theory. You may have heard of it. But basically what it says is that one small change that is put in one particular place in a complex system can actually have a far-reaching effect. So they call it the butterfly effect because they talk about how the flap of a butterfly's wings in the atmosphere can change, can lead to a chain reaction of things that happen to things that happen, things that happen, and ultimately can change weather patterns or move a tornado to this town instead of that town. This is the theory. But I like it. And if you think of it, we use it in popular culture. It's a Wonderful Life, that wonderful Christmas movie we watch every year, right? One thing, one choice George made, things change forever. It's in science fiction. It's in other movies, Back to the Future. That's an old one. My kids like watching Doctor Who. It's in there as well. Lots of places, time travel. My point is it gives me hope, right? One small change in this place, we just don't know. And that's where we're not working alone. We're working with God, right? So ways to respond. How can we respond? First one, I think, is we can learn about what is going on. We can learn about what is going on. What do we know about what goes on in our world, in our country, about where our food comes from or our clothes? When we go to make a purchase, do we think about the justice implications of our choice? It's another layer of consideration, and we're very good at thinking about cost and design and function and quality. And what I'm suggesting to you is one of the actions we can take is to learn more and to be more aware of the choices that we make and the impacts that they have. I think there's another thing we can learn, and that is that we can learn to reject partial information. When we are trying to, when we are on a path towards oppression, the first step is just accepting uncritically partial information. It leads to bias and prejudice and stereotypes and discrimination and on down all those isms. So when we hear information, just a piece, we live in Canada, everybody can better themselves if they want to. There's pieces of truth to that, but what's the more complicated truth? What's the whole picture? And how can I learn and understand and think critically about what I hear and what I'm told, the things we hear on the radio, in the media, in our neighborhoods, etc. So once we have learned, then we can speak. I like this verse from Proverbs. It says, "Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and the needy." So how can we speak? Where can we speak? Can we counter some of that partial information and bias that is thrown around out there? When is it appropriate, and how do I best take a public stance? And how can I do that in a helpful ways? I was in the office of our local MPP just over a week ago, and we were talking about some of the justice issues that we're involved in at MCC, and we were having a good conversation, but we got to talking about what politicians hear. And he said lately he's been hearing, and some of his fellow, his colleagues have been hearing, a lot of the things that come with those isms that I mentioned before, capitalism, consumerism, and individualism. What about me? Don't take it from my pocket. I have enough of my own stuff to deal with. Things that don't match that downward mobility, those kingdom values we were talking about. And he said to me, or to us, the couple of us that were there, that no politician is going to do something that is opposite to what they're hearing. So my question as I left in my head was, where is our voice? Where is my voice? And there's some discouragement as we work to try to move some things forward, that and in our work, that other voices seem so loud, that the issues are so complicated, that people have a lot on and so aren't really, don't appear to be interested in engaging too deeply into some of these things. But what I know is, if we believe that there is another way, and if we want to live in communities that are just and compassionate, then we need to find our voice and we need to speak up. So we have options to speak up this year. We have an election on May the 2nd. We have a provincial election coming up in the fall. So what do we need to learn, and how do we need to speak up? Where can we engage? How do we use our voice? We have a right, we have a privilege, and we have a responsibility to vote. And we do that by learning about the different parties, learning what people are saying, figuring out how that matches up with our understanding of our values and so on, and then using our voice. And then finally, I want to share our resources. Mother Teresa has a difficult quote. She says, "When a poor person dies of hunger, it has not happened because God did not take care of him or her. It has happened because neither you nor I wanted to give that person what he or she needed." James says, "If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words and speech, but with actions and in truth." So how can we figure out ways to move beyond giving out of our abundance and begin to give out of sacrificial giving? So it's a way of our world to do all we can, spend tons of energy getting more and more stuff, and then tons more energy trying to protect the stuff that we have. And no choice is made in a vacuum. Resources can't be spent twice. So how can we share in ways that make the most effective use of our resources? Two final thoughts found in two quotes. There are two quotes, actually, that I want to share with you. This one, by St. John of the Cross: "A Christian should always remember that the value of good works are not based on their number and excellence, but on the love of God which prompts him to do these things." What we've been talking about is a tall order, and that's why we root it in spiritual transformation. And this is the key to sustaining our work. We rise to this challenge because we are called to do so, not because we know we will be able to complete the task. And the other quote is this one by Edmund Burke, which is, "Nobody made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could only do a little." It's a big elephant. We start one bite at a time, but we must begin with a bite. I invite you to look at your outline, and you will see three shapes at the bottom there. They look kind of like this. There they are. So, one thing I will stop doing, one thing I will start doing, and one thing I will continue doing. And I'd encourage you to take that first bite out of this elephant that we're all working against and think of one thing that maybe you will stop doing. One thing that maybe you're going to start doing. Maybe it's buying fairly traded coffee instead of our local Tim Hortons. Feels kind of un-Canadian to say that, but one thing I can stop doing and start doing, and one thing I can continue doing, one of the things that I'm doing and that I can kind of reinvest in and keep on doing. So take a minute, tune me out here for a minute, and think, because this much I do know about human nature. If I go, "That sounds like a really good thing to do, I'm going to do it later," it's going to end up in the recycling. So I'm going to give you just a minute here, and then I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a few other resources to get you started. So take a minute and think. Well, hopefully that's enough time to get your thinking caps on anyway, and you can feel free to revisit that this afternoon or at another time. But on the next page of your bulletin, it says, taking the first bite, resources to get you started. And I just want to point some of these out. I hesitated a little bit because there's not just one way to do this, or because the best way are those actions that are unique and that are specific and concrete, none of which fit cleanly into a model. But I also know that for me, having an example helps. And so here are a few ways to get you started to try to get a handle on how you might act. This one, the See, Judge, Act method, comes from a Catholic order, a way they have of getting a handle on justice. And basically, it calls us to awareness, to be able to be open to seeing what's going on. And there's a list of some questions that you might ask yourself, to be able to analyze what's going on and how that fits in with what we think and understand. And then calling us to action, to not just be disgusted or angry or feel hopeless, but to actually take an action. And there's some questions there as well to talk about what we might do. Another resource is called The Radical Experiment. David Platt wrote a book called The Radical. It came out in the wintertime. And in it, he has a radical experiment. It's about discipleship and following that red letter living that we're talking about as well. And so he's got five specific challenges, and I list them there. Pray for the entire world. Read through the entire word. Commit your life to multiplying community, which is committing yourself to the local church and to a small group. Sacrifice your money for a specific purpose, which is looking through your budget, making some specific and intentional choices, and then choosing where to send those resources that you free up. And then spend your time in another context. And they suggest 2%, which is 1 week of your year, to work that's outside of church, work that's in our communities, work that takes us outside of our comfort zones. So that's a second method. The third option or resource there is called the STEP model for action. And this one's particularly good if a particular issue caught your attention, something today or in the news or that's on your mind. It's a possible way to move from thinking about it to doing something about it, and it's these steps up here, and it's just identifying a process of what I will do next week, one thing I'll do next month, one thing I'll do 6 months from now, and then also identifying the resources I have and the people who are around me who can help and how we might move on from there. And then finally, I mentioned a book by Julie Clausen, which is called Everyday Justice, which is all about taking those little bites. She's from Dallas. She's a mom. She lives in suburbia, so to speak. And so I think she resonates with a lot of us in that our lives are full and busy. We want to do this. How do we make this? How do we take those first bites? So that's a good book. One other resource that I did not put in your bulletin, but I wanted to mention to you, is a book that comes out next month. It's called The Practice of Love, and it's edited by Jonathan Brink. It's a compilation of chapters written by people who are practicing God's love in the hard and messy places in North America. People who've decided to live red in extravagant and creative ways in their communities. And I am looking forward to reading it. I know the work of some of the contributors. And I think we get to the point where we say, this is what I want to be, this is what I want to be doing. But downward mobility is so foreign to our culture that it's hard to imagine what it might look like in practice. And so I think it's important to hear from those who have forged a path, not so that we can copy it exactly, but so we can kind of get a glimpse of what's on the other side. So hopefully those resources will give you a place to start. There's lots more out there, of course. But as we leave this morning, I'd like to leave you with a Franciscan benediction. As you go into the week ahead and as you try to figure out how in your own life, in your own families, how in our own church here, we can tackle this elephant. So let me pray this for you. May God bless you with discomfort at easy answers, half-truths, and superficial relationships so that you may live deep within your heart. May God bless you with anger at injustice, oppression, and exploitation of people so that you may work for justice, freedom, and peace. May God bless you with tears to shed for those who suffer pain, rejection, hunger, and war, so that you may reach out your hand to comfort them and to turn their pain into joy. And may God bless you with enough foolishness to believe that you can make a difference in the world, so that you can do what others claim cannot be done, to bring justice and kindness to all God's children and the poor. Amen. Go in peace.
Inside the mystery.